Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey, Billy, why don't we tell them what we're about, man?
So we're here to welcome you to the Madhouse Chronicles. It's a talk show with myself, Billy Morrison.
And me, Ozzy Osbourne.
This man, Prince of Darkness. And we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Come and join Ozzy and myself. Visit osbournemediahouse.com to get special access to...
Come on!
What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, it's Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. We have another great New York City guitarist with us today. We're with Will Bernard. He's actually another New York transplant from Berkeley and lives in Brooklyn, studied guitar and piano at an early age. Received a degree in music from UC Berkeley and began playing and recording on an international level as a member of Peter Applebaum's Hieroglyphics Ensemble, who made their recorded debut with Don Cherry in 1989 on the album Multiculti. Since then, Will's participated in a host of boundary-stretching groups, which is true. You've got a pretty wide taste there, ranging from jazz, hip-hop, and world music to experimental music with a lot of stops in between, including groups ranging from the Hindustani-influenced Jai Atal. Do I pronounce that right?
Utah.
What is it?
Utah.
Jai Utah. I'm sorry. I'm going to butcher these. Just going to give you a heads up. To the political hip-hop group, The Coup. The most commercially successful of these projects was the group TJ Kirk, which was with Charlie Hunter, and their sophomore album, If Four Was One, on Warner Brothers, was nominated for a Grammy in 1997. TJ Kirk was a band that was named for the three musicians whose music it covered: jazz keyboardist Thelonious Monk, James Brown, and saxophonist Rahsaan Roland Kirk. Will made further inroads with the Stanton Moore Trio, which toured extensively and made three albums on Telarc. He broke out as a bandleader himself in 98 with the release of Medicine Hat, showcasing his expert chops and a flair for funky, bottom-heavy soul jazz. He's since released six more records and was nominated for a Grammy Award in 2008 for the Best Contemporary Jazz Album. He's toured extensively with his own bands and as a member of the Stanton Moore Trio, Robert Walters 20th Congress, Groundation, and numerous other lineups. He's also opened for Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters, Jimmy McGriff, the Funky Meters, John Scofield, Medeski Martin and Wood, Zigaboo Modaliste, and the Charlie Hunter Quartet. He's performed and recorded with Dr. Lonnie Smith, Tom Waits, Ben Sidran, Bernard Purdy, Dr. John, Booker T. Jones, Stephen Bernstein's Millennial Territory Orchestra, Butler Bernstein and the Hot Nine, George Porter Jr., again Zigaboo Modaliste, Global Noise, Grey Boy All-Stars, Galactic, Medeski Martin and Wood, Idris Muhammad, and others. As well as leading his own groups, he performs regularly with the New York collaborative electro-funk band called Pleasure Drones, the WBs with Will Blades, and San Francisco's Clubfoot Orchestra, Peter Applebaum's Sparkler, and John Medeski's Mad Skillet with Kirk Joseph and Terrence Higgins. And he just flew back from San Fran last night. Man, I appreciate your time, Will. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate being on.
You're originally from Berkeley. What made you move to New York City?
Well, I'd always felt kind of aligned with the New York music scene and, you know, followed it pretty closely. And I made a lot of visits out here. I come and stay a week or two. Sometimes I'd stay in Adam Levy's apartment when he was out on the road with Nora Jones or, you know, different friends. And, you know, there was just different times when I thought I would move here and then something else happened that stopped me from doing that. Like, you know, in the 90s, all these groups that you mentioned that I was playing with, or, you know, San Francisco was a really hopping scene, you know, at that point. But, you know, finally I just, it's time to come out and experience it, you know. And that was 2007, I guess I mentioned, when we came out.
What did you do to get gigs when you first came out? I mean, I guess you knew people, so that was did they wire you into some stuff or?
Right at that point, I was touring a lot with Stanton Moore Trio, and I knew tons of people here when I came, and you know, just kind of fell right in, and I got a lot of gigs right away, and you know, it kind of goes up and down. There's a very competitive place.
Sure.
Not a lot of people really have regular great gigs here. You know, they tour or they, you know, there's a lot of small places to play. And
sure.
But it's a good, you know, meeting ground. And, you know, there's always amazing musicians to play with.
Scott made a comment. He said, the toughest thing about the city is you have to crack through sort of like the, you know, the inner circle, and it takes a, you know, you got to earn your stripes. And once you earn your stripes and you're accepted, then, you know, you have access to that network that you're sort of talking about. Did you find that the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of look at it in a more international kind of context. Like, there's all these people that are all over the place that I work with, you know. I work with people in New Orleans a lot. And, but yeah, I mean, of course he's true about that, and he's done very well in the fields he's working in.
Yeah, for sure.
One thing about, I think about my, the way I play, my musical interests is they're kind of all over the map.
Yeah, man.
So there's a lot of different ladders I have to climb, you know, if I want to. Most people are like focus on one kind of music and one world of, you know, I'm simultaneously trying to do jazz gigs and some like jam band-y kind of things and some more experimental.
Yeah, a lot of your stuff leans towards experimental and just not, I'd say unconventional, probably a better word.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's kind of a range. I go from one end to the other. Some stuff I guess I would think is pretty conventional. Maybe other people don't think is that conventional.
Right. I totally get that, man. Well, speaking of that, talk about Peter Apfelbaum and that and ensemble. For people who don't know what kind of stuff you played, and also how'd you get hooked up with them?
Well, Peter Apfelbaum was one of my oldest friends and influences. I first heard him play music in kindergarten. He was a prodigy.
Wow.
He performed on, you know, in our playground on a full drum set when he was in kindergarten. So he's always been kind of a star of the Berkeley Schools, Berkeley Jazz Program, that, you know, that was through Berkeley High and even younger when we were kids, it went down to elementary school. Now I think it's mostly just Berkeley High, but there's still amazing players coming out of there all the time and getting signed to record labels. And Charlie Hunter went there.
Yeah.
And the other guitar players, a lot of horn players. Like Josh Redman, Craig Handy, and Ambrose, the trumpet player.
Talk about what kind of music you guys do there, because it's pretty interesting.
With the Hieroglyphics Ensemble?
With Peter Apfelbaum.
Peter, yeah. Well, there was along with the jazz program, there's a lot of influences in the Bay Area that we that fed us musically, like a lot of international influences, especially when we were coming up. I mean, they're still there, but it was really part of the scene in Afro-Cuban music and West African music, and then just drawing from a lot of different types of music. There was a school called Center for World Music that I went to. I studied Javanese gamelan music. And
how old were you?
Like 15.
Wow.
And I was exposed to music from all over the world. So that, that kind of changes your outlook. And then there was groups like Fela Kuti and King Sunny Ade that, I don't know, maybe Joe Gore talked about that a little bit, but they brought a lot of that African music to the Bay Area.
Yeah, he's got a big like African music collection, if I remember correctly, Joe does.
I met him when I was at UC Berkeley. He was a grad student there, actually.
And I think his parents maybe taught there or taught at one of the universities.
That I don't know about.
Yeah, they're academics, I'm pretty sure. Did you open up for the Dead?
We did with Applebaum's group. We did three times, actually.
What was that like, man? And do you have any funny or dead fan stories?
Actually, yes. 2 days ago, I was just at Bob Weir's TRI Studios hanging out. I got a new the guy Rich Hogue, who builds guitars for me and also works on my guitars, and I usually bring him over and we hang out. He's a really good friend, but he builds Bob's guitars. So he built this new gray Strat, custom Strat that he's using. So we went over to, he went over to help him with his guitars, and I went by. So the Dead are kind of a big force in the Bay Area, and they've affected us all growing up. Mm-hmm. And we opened for him, I think I'd seen him a number of times before that, and I wasn't a huge fan. I liked him, but I feel like I really got them when one night when we opened, we played the Oakland Coliseum on New Year's Eve, and we opened for them.
Wow. That's pretty significant, man.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Were there, and we were the first of three, and I've never done anything like that before, and I was pretty nervous, and we did a short set, and it was like this Hieroglyphics ensemble is like a 16-piece group, probably nobody seen anything like it. A lot of the people there probably hadn't seen anything like it, and it went well, but I was kind of nervous. And,
yeah.
And later on, when the Dead came out, they're like sitting there tuning their guitars for like a minute, before in between songs, and it's just so relaxed in front of like 14,000 people. I'm like, wow, I guess I really get it now,
Yeah.
It's a beautiful part of what they do, is just how relaxed and, it's just all about playing music.
Yeah,
it's a show, or something.
Very, very laid back vibe. I saw them once in like 80. I think it was probably 83 upstate New York in Binghamton. And I have to say, I don't remember a lot about that night, but it was, it was a very laid back thing for sure. Very communal,
yeah.
And this is before that word communal even existed. What is this? 33 years ago,
Yeah.
We mentioned this earlier. What turns you on most about your music is kind of out on the fringes. And again, that's what you made a good point. It's perspective to you. It's not out on the fringes because that's where you live, out on the fringes, musically at least, or part of where you live.
According to who, I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So so forget about fringes. What turns you on most about the music?
What a lot of people know about music is such a minuscule part of what music really is in the big picture, It's like
totally.
It's like if you want to know about, say, like food, but all you've had is a McDonald's burger, you know.
Yeah, your range.
And if you're like somebody has gazpacho, is that, I mean, maybe it's like out on the fringe to the one person, but the other person is like a daily meal, you know. So,
totally get that.
So
what, forget about fringes or anything like that. What turns you on most about the music that you're playing?
I'm trying to say is that I'm curious, you know, I like to explore and listen to a lot of different kinds of music and try to play a lot of different kinds of music. And, you know, I've been doing it a really long time, so I get a chance to try a lot of different things, you know.
For sure, man. Are you working on anything now that you're excited about?
Well, I have, there's one project I did, that's really fun. I'll probably end up recording. It's called that. We call it the BK Strays. And it's, mostly music of Billy Strayhorn, some Duke Ellington. I was kind of inspired by, I love, Western swing music and the Bob Wills and the way they would do like a whole big band with string instruments, you know, like, I'm sure you know about Bob Wills and a Western swing style, but so I wanted to try to approach that with something like, Billy Strayhorn, you know, and Duke, which I haven't really heard anybody do that. So I transcribed a bunch of stuff from Billy Strayhorn, which is kind of a challenge, you know. It's like a little bit. Some sort of not well-known pieces, you know. We're not doing all the chestnuts like Lush Life, and but we do A Train. We do Bob Wills' version of A Train,
That's really cool. What is the deal with there's so much, like so many people in Brooklyn into Western swing? I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, right. Lucas loves it.
Smokey Hormel.
Smokey.
I mean, just a lot of people. And there's a big bluegrass thing going on there now.
I've always loved it. You know, like, well, we had the group TJ Kirk. I was, you know, I'm still listening to the same stuff I was listening to then. You know, a lot of that stuff for me was some of the arrangements was influenced by Western swing. You know, I don't know if you've heard any of that music, but.
I've heard a little bit of it. It's not really my cup of tea, to be honest with you. I mean, these guys are incredibly talented musicians that I, you know, pick up pretty quickly.
But two of our records. We did two records on Warner Brothers, and they're out of print now. I don't even think you can get them on Spotify or anything.
Oh, the TJ Kirk stuff.
Yeah. I don't really understand why. But, you know, I think you would probably like some of it's pretty mainstream, I guess. Some of it's not, but anyway, we did it was basically two guitars and then me, myself, John Schott playing guitar and then Charlie Hunter playing the 8-string guitar. So we had a lot of possibilities for harmonies and playing melodies together, like Western swing style. So that kind of, that was a little bit of the idea I had during this TJ, it's almost the same name.
BK Strays.
So I'm excited about that, and then I have like two other records of original music that I'm kind of conceptualizing anyway at this point.
Very cool, man. Is it possible, you've done so many different things, is it possible to say like what are your top three musical experiences?
Well, and when I think about that, I think really my favorite thing is when I write a piece of music and I finish it and get it played with a group. You know, it's like really, if I don't like it, it's not good. But, you know, it's like at least I'll usually like it at least the first couple times we play it. But there's nothing like that to me. That kind of may have been the thing that really kept me going when I first started writing music in high school.
Bringing it to life with real life musicians.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
I had a teacher, Art Landy, who's he lives in Boulder now. He's a piano player, but he had a composition class. We had to come in every week and with a new composition for whoever was in the class, you know, kind of jazz, like just jazz tunes really, but it's so exciting, you know, for me to do that.
So you really, writing is one of the favorite things you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think that my guitar playing sort of comes out of that. Like I try to be compositional in my guitar playing, like play something that has a, you know, melodic ideas, statements, or something that makes sense in a musical way. You know.
What would be number two favorite experience?
I really do love touring. You know, I don't know if there's a
particular
time. You know, but it's fun. I love playing in front of enthusiastic audiences, you know.
Favorite audience you've played in front of?
My favorites would be this group where I had called Blue Plate Special with Stanton Moore and John Medeski and Andy Hess. And when we got to do that, you know, I got to play a sold-out show at a couple of sold-out shows, one in San Francisco, one in Brooklyn, you know. I felt good, you know, be doing my own music with these guys. And we did Blue Plate show this year at a Jazz Fest, actually. And we had added a Skerrick on saxophone, and Chris Wood was the bass player, Stanton Moore and John Medeski.
Some good musicians.
You know, when I love performing in other groups and collaborations, but it's kind of, you know, when I have my own music and it's coming off well, it's pretty exciting.
What was your childhood like growing up in Berkeley?
Well, my mom was a school teacher in Berkeley Unified School District, and there was a time of a lot of change in the '60s. We had busing and integrated schools. And I was, you know, bused down. We lived in Berkeley Hills, and I was bused down to this big elementary school, which is actually where first time, you know, had music classes in school. But we were exposed to a lot of different kinds of music, like gospel music, you know, Edwin Hopkins singers, you know, had Oh Happy Day. We were like backing up, you know, kids singing that. And I started out on violin, actually. But that was like kind of the first time, you know, Peter Applebaum and Rodney Franklin and other people were kind of the child prodigies. And, yeah, it was the first time I got to see like these people going crazy in the audiences for music. And,
yeah.
Took me a while to get into jazz. I was more into rock, you know, when I grew up.
Like what? But,
you know, a lot of classic, what's now classic rock, it wasn't called classic rock then.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so it's like 70s and 80s stuff.
Yeah, 70s and 60s, really. Like, I was into Led Zeppelin, you know, they were one of my faves.
It's amazing to listen to your music now that you're a Zeppelin. Your music is so far, it's removed from like that now. It's wild.
I don't feel like it is at all.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, like if you listen to Stanton Moore, his two biggest influences are on drums are, two of them are Zigaboo Modaliste from New Orleans and John Bonham.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
We even did Zeppelin covers, you know. We did When the Levee Breaks.
Great song. It's like one of my favorite Zeppelin songs, man.
Yeah. So, I actually saw them a couple times.
Did you? Out in San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
Man, you guys got to see some great shows out there.
Berkeley High, we had our theater, what was called the Berkeley Community Theater, right? you know about that? Like Jimmy Plays Berkeley.
Oh, that was there.
Yeah, it was at our high school.
Holy crap!
Auditorium, and we had our classrooms were at the backstage area of that of the auditorium. So that was kind of like what I thought was the best thing in the world when I was growing up. Is
yeah, I would bet.
There, you know? That's so cool. Small. There were Bill Graham shows. It was one of his venues, you know.
At the Berkeley Auditorium, mm-hmm. at the Berkeley Community. Wow, that's yeah. really cool. What were
So then, you know, I got into like I was around the time when fusion was really good, and I totally got into all that stuff. You know, I saw Weather Report and many times, and Mom Vishnu, and then I got into Frank Zappa. Really changed my life. You know, maybe that's what got me more into the fringes. But yeah. I was always interested in more unusual music, I think. So
it's funny, everybody that's in like our age group, that especially from seems to be most of the guys out west, they all say back when fusion was good.
Yeah,
everybody says, no one just says I like fusion, they say I like fusion when fusion was good.
Yeah,
how do you feel it's changed?
Well, you know, I feel like in a way it's really coming back these days. And maybe it's, I mean, we didn't want to use the word fusion for years, you know.
Yeah,
it was a bad word.
I spoke to a guy out in California. He said the F word. He said it's called. He goes, I don't want to say, but I actually like fusion. He goes, I know it's the F word, but you know. And he said the same thing. He feels it's coming back. But
yeah, I mean, there's like if you see these groups like Nowhere and Snarky Puppy and
yeah, Snarky Puppy's great, man.
I mean, they're pretty much fusion, and they don't. I don't know what they call themselves. I mean, they do a lot of different things, but
they do a lot of funky stuff too.
It's like, you know, it's fusion to me.
Yeah.
And I like them, you know, and they're really, they have a lot of influence. We played their festival a couple of years ago, Mad Skillet.
Oh, the one in Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I play with some of those people around here, you know, they kind of float around.
Yeah. Chris
Fuller.
Bob Lanzetti's in Brooklyn, I think, isn't he?
I don't know which one is. He's one of the guitar players.
Yeah, glasses, beard. I'm pretty sure he's in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
probably. Yeah, and Chris McQueen, because I interviewed all three of them. Chris is in Austin or Dallas, and then Mark Lettieri. I don't remember where Mark is. I think he's out in California. I don't remember, yeah. Yeah, but they were great, great bands, Snarky Puppy.
Yeah, I mean... It's interesting because, like, Modesky, Martin, Wood, they're kind of, you know, I got interested in, like, in the 90s when, I guess you would call it beginnings of, like, soul jazz, acid jazz, jam band, whatever, kind of got started. I was pretty interested in that, what was going on, because in a way, it wasn't fusion. You know, it was more about... feel and soul, and I like guys like Frizzell was like kind of my favorite guitar player around that time, beginning of the 90s, you know. But I also like Scofield a lot, for the way he would be very melodic and understated, you know, instead of playing a lot of fast notes, which became like what you do, you know, in that context.
Sure.
So like Modesky, Martin Wood, you know, they're around that time, and they, you know, I think they were pretty much anti-fusion. It was kind of their whole approach, you know, just being really sparse and more about sound and texture and things like that. So I don't know where I'm going with it. It's a big subject, but
no, it's all good, man. What were some amazing?
This is all just titles and genre names, anyways.
Absolutely, man. It's weird because it's inescapable now because everything's broken down and has a label. Like, you know, I was talking to somebody about that this morning. Like, you know, the Eagles or Jackson Brown, right? That was just, or Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that was rock. Now it's Americana.
Right.
You know, like, okay.
Yeah, when the first fusion stuff started, we, you know, we called it jazz rock.
Right.
To combine jazz and rock.
Right.
That was the only criteria. You know, or like somebody like Miles Davis was doing that, you know, obviously one of the first people. But it was something that was kind of obvious and made sense, you know.
Yeah, and then Yes and all them bands came along. It was progressive.
And then you got like super technical guys, and then the smooth jazz, you know, kind of came out of these things, which I wasn't really into either of those.
Yeah.
But I like the rawness of the, that's, I guess, why we say I like that it was good, because there's a rawness there.
Yeah, there is. Hey, what were some of the maybe the low points or the bigger obstacles that you've had to deal with over your career, and how did you manage to get through those?
Well, I mean, it's been definitely had its up and downs, you know. And I've had, you know, I have a lot of records that are out of print that I, you know, put out, you know.
Yeah.
That have, there, one even didn't get put out. There was a band I was in called Pothole, and I got signed to Verve after we did T.J. Kirk, and Warner Brothers got a little bit of notice and got a deal with Verve and Tilly's for my first record. And then they said, oh, well, you have this other band, Pothole, which is kind of more a collaborative group. And we want to sign that too. And we'd already made the record for another label. And so they bought it from the other label, and then they just didn't ever put it out.
Nice.
Like a lot of years and years of, and this happens a lot for people. You know.
I hear this all the time.
Yeah. So that was a sad kind of musical industry experience. And now, you know, people are putting out their own records for a lot more. Which, you know, that's not easy either. We're doing a Kickstarter campaign right now for Mad Skillet.
How's it going?
John Medeski's doing it. It's going pretty well, you know. I mean, but then you realize how much it really takes to do a record all the way right with publicity. And it takes a lot.
Well, then, the big problem is a lot of musicians are not marketers,
right?
So once you get it, then you're like, "Well, fuck! Now I got to sell this thing."
Right.
Well, I mean, and you don't, and like, if that's not what you do, it's literally like, what? I mean, like, you know, what do you? It's like if someone said to me, "Hey, man, you need to go up and put a new roof on." I mean, I'd need a lot of hours in front of YouTube to figure that out, man. You know, seriously, it's not my thing. So, or build a house, or, you know, repair my, you know, pull the motor mounts off my car. You know, it's a whole separate gig.
Yeah, well, publicists are some of the people who are still making money.
Yeah.
Music, you know, typical, you gotta pay like at least, you know, a few thousand dollars, you know, to get a good publicist for
a month,
a record, really, you know,
yeah,
to be a record, you know, that's a good chunk of money for most of us.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I don't know if I should say this there. I've had running the show. I have a lot of publicists I deal with, or I've had some, and man, it's amazing how, you know, like any other profession, you know, there's a bell curve of like, you know, the top 5 or 10% at the top. But man, you know, you got 80% of them are just like, you know, whatever, you know, it just amazes me, you know.
They don't do the job well, or they're not prepared.
But they just don't follow up. It's, you know, yeah. You know, it's just you know, it's like any other profession. It's like if you call someone to fix your pool or call someone to repair your oven, you know, I mean, it's like, it's hit or miss, man. You know, I mean, most of the time maybe you'll get an average job, you know, 80% of the time, and, you know, or less, average or less, you know, it's rare that you get somebody that's really on top of their shit.
Right. Well, there's a lot of hurdles, you know, unless you're famous already.
Right.
They go through a lot of hurdles to get you reviewed or noticed.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's not really their fault if you don't get things out of it. But.
You're very benevolent.
No, yeah. <I know.
laughs>
Most of the time, it's their fault. No.
Well, no. Let me give you a concrete example.
What's really going on, I guess.
Well, let me give you a concrete example. A lot of times, and I deal with some very nice publicists, and I'm just giving some experience. If you're a publicist and you're listening to this, I'm probably not talking about you. So that was a great disclaimer, wasn't it? So like I'll connect with someone. Either they call me or I reach out to them. And more and more as the show gets bigger, you know, they're emailing me and I might be interested in somebody that they're representing. And they'll be like, yeah, man, that's great. And then I never hear from them. It's like literally like, you know, they fell into the vacuum of, and I'm like, man, you know, if you have somebody that's actually interested in your artist and has a platform and you have expressed an interest and you do not follow up, it's really weird. Like, why would you not do that? I don't care. It's like, there's a lot of people I have to interview, but I'm just like, I never understand that. And really I feel like they've wasted my time. That's like, you know, that's all, you know, you can make money, you can't make time, man. So that's the most precious commodity. So I'm like really protective, but yeah, I mean, like I'm disciplined with my time, you know? So,
Well, you know, musicians, it's hard enough, like playing music and trying to make a good record and make a statement, you know, and it's like, and then you got to do all this other stuff too. You know, it's like,
right.
It's pretty, can be daunting. You know?
Well, that's one thing. You look at Snarky Puppy, all of those guys have really good social media presence. I mean, they get it. They know that, hey, this is, you know, that old expression, if it's meant to be, it's up to me, right? And they kind of all get that and they all hustle and they're all involved in so many other projects. So there's a lot of bleed over from one thing to the next and they're really pumping stuff out. All of them, they're pretty good about that.
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you this. If you could go back and give advice to young Will Bernard, what do you think you would have told yourself that would have made your life easier?
I would have just been more, you know, when I look back, you know, the things that have helped me the most is when I stuck my neck out, you know, do something, whether you fail or not, you know, just go out and do it, you know, and, you know, I was probably less, I'm still not super aggressive, but you know, I was a lot more introverted when I was younger. And I guess I would have told myself, you know, you got to go out and do these things you're thinking about in public. Or, you know, I also feel like I can't really regret the way things go because it made me who I am. And, you know, I feel okay. But, pretty good about who I am and what I've accomplished and what I've made.
Sure.
Like the musical, where I'm musically right now, I feel is the best I've ever been, you know?
That's awesome. That's a good feeling, man.
So, and then, you know, I wouldn't be who I am if I hadn't grown up in Berkeley. And, you know, sometimes I think, well, maybe I should have moved to New York sooner or, then I sound like a New York guy. Now I have my own, I feel like sometimes I have my own unique way of playing music, which is
great. If you're happy with it, it's freaking what
I've done, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously I have a lot to work on. We all have things to work on.
Hell yeah, man, for sure. Maybe I don't know if this is answerable. Do you have a favorite guitar player?
That isn't really answerable, but I keep going back to, you know, one guy I will never get tired of is Wes Montgomery. I love a lot of players, but I always just love hearing him So I don't know if he's my favorite, but he's a guy you can always put on, and I will always listen to him.
Yep, I hear you, man. A lot of people feel that way about Wes. Hey, let's talk.
I used to say, like, Jim, my triad was Wes, Jimi Hendrix, and Django Reinhardt. But I don't know if I'd say that now. But Jimmy had a huge influence on me. He was kind of one of the guys that made me want to play guitar.
Yeah, man, a lot of guys have said that about Jimi Hendrix.
I think, like, those two guys were so natural, the way they play. That was part of the thing I like about them, is just there's an honest, sort of natural, soulful way they play.
Yeah, very much. That's what you mentioned, actually, about that you liked about the Dead's rapport. It was very natural, very easygoing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, very complex, too.
Musically complex, but, you know, attitudinally very natural.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally.
Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. What's your, like, go-to guitar right now, and what other two round out your top three?
Well, I have that's a good question. Well, I have this Starfire 3, 1964 Starfire 3 with a Bigsby. I just love. That comes along with me a lot. And then
is that the one that looks like a 335? Is that
the single cutaway? It's a totally hollow, like an ES-330. And there's these pickups that are they're sort of twangy, but they're also warm, so you can get a kind of a jazz sound out of it, but you can also kind of surf out and rock out on it. And it's warm sounding at low volumes. I like that one, and then I have a few different ES-335s. I have, I mentioned Rich Hoag made me this beautiful Strat. You know, we dialed in the neck shape, and it just plays beautifully. And I use that. I have mini humbuckers on it.
How many?
Two mini humbuckers.
And then you have a single coil? Or just too many? Oh, do you have that? Is that nearby?
Yeah.
Man, I'd like to see that.
Okay.
If it's not a problem, thanks. Okay, now we need commercial music. Like I need like some Muzak to play right now.
I can show you the both the Guild and the, I have them both out.
Yeah, that'd be great, man.
So here's the... can you see us?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wow. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
So that's the Rich Hoag one. It's a Strat looking guitar. Yeah. It's so wild seeing mini humbuckers in a Strat. It's black with a turquoise, not turquoise, turtle. What's that called? Turtle?
Tortoiseshell.
Yeah. Tortoiseshell. Right. With a pick guard. Really cool looking. And wow. It's really weird seeing mini humbuckers on a Strat.
Yeah. You know, it's the same. Maybe it's a little similar to the way this is designed in terms of. I haven't checked out the.
So that's the Starfire.
Starfire, but you know it's not big and thick like humbuckers. You know, it's got what mini humbuckers.
Have. Yeah,
these are kind of like mini humbuckers too.
Yeah, they look like so the Guild Starfire. It's a single. It's like a like an ES-135 because it's thin.
Yeah, and they make a different. They make them without the Bigsby. They make them with the block in the middle, like a 335.
Man, and you said that's a 64. That could has that been painted, repainted, or something?
No,
that's in great shape.
The back is pretty messed up, and then most of the finishes off the neck.
Yeah, but man, it's 54 years old.
I know.
Holy shit!
I had to have the electronics. Kind of redone, put wax. Rich put wax in the pickups to make them less microphonic. You know?
That's very
I used
cool,
to
man.
Out on the new Mad Skillet record.
Very cool, man.
And I still have my old. I have a '66 ES-335 that I got in high school that I've used a lot for recordings.
That's really cool.
It sounds beautiful.
Dude, that's like retirement.
It's not one of the, you know, super sought after $20,000 ones.
Oh, know. It's not?
It's a 66. I think once you get after 64, they go down in price.
That's weird. I don't wonder why.
Yeah, I get, you know, part of it is those PAF pickups.
Okay.
Like in the 50s.
Yeah.
That everybody wanted. And then also like the neck taper is a little different. And also they put on the trapeze tailpiece, which I love.
Yeah, I like that.
It has a little more of a jazz sound.
I like that, yeah.
People don't like that sound either.
Do you remember the first record or CD that you purchased? No, it would be record, not be a CD.
It would be record, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you look 25, but I think it might be record, not.
Well, my mom was very into classical music and got me listen. You know, I heard a lot of classical music. So the two records, first ones I got were Meet the Beatles, and I got a Schubert record, Franz Schubert trios, piano trios. Stern Rose Estaman Trio.
Meet the Beatles and Franz Schubert.
Kind of put me in my path.
Yeah, there. Man. That's why you're on this journey here, man. How about Desert Island Disc? I'm scared to even hear what's going to come out of your mouth. Three, just for today, man, because I know that this question could change tomorrow and the next day. Knee jerk sure. reaction to top three Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, well, that's like I think, well, if I'm in the desert island, I'm going to want to listen to this stuff over and over again so I get some, like, complicated classical music, you know, probably like some Beethoven string quartet, maybe. And then I would probably get, how many do I get to choose?
Three.
Three?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I'd probably get a Wes Montgomery record, like, I say Smoking in the Half Note was always my favorite. And then, you know, I realized I was reading these interviews with this guy, other guitar players. Yeah, that's my favorite.
Yeah, and I've heard several guys tell me that.
I think Pat Metheny was one of the guys that mentioned that. You know. And then, yeah, I don't know, third. That's a good question. I don't know about the third one. what would I get? I'd probably get some kind of feel-good funk record, you know, like a Meters record or a
James Brown
or Parliament Funkadelic, you know?
Yeah, I love old James Brown, man.
Yeah.
All right, man, the questions get hard now, especially for a guy like you who's a little bit shy.
Okay.
So hang on. This is a tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself?
I guess I like my openness.
That's really cool.
Ability to appreciate a lot of different things and not close myself off to things, whether it be art or music or. You know, I give everything a chance.
That's really cool. Very nice, man. How about the flip side? Anything you'd want to change about yourself? One thing you'd want to change about yourself?
Yeah, probably be more confident.
Something or someone you miss from your childhood?
I miss my mom. She passed away a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
Sorry a lot.
Very sorry. Really sorry to hear that.
She was a great woman. And, you know, when people are gone, you really see how great they are. You know? Maybe you didn't always appreciate everything.
Man, I feel like that about my wife, man. I really appreciate her so much. And like, I was just telling her last night, if something ever happened to her, man, I'd be a fucking basket case. I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty sad.
That's when you're in later in life, and we start losing people, it's pretty hard to figure out how to process that. You know, and losing a lot of great musicians that are either big yeah. influence or friends, you know, or yeah. people I've worked with, you know.
Who have you lost that you've worked with, if you're comfortable saying?
Well, recently, Henry Butler, a great piano player, New Orleans piano player, died. We kind of saw that coming because he had cancer, but he was fighting it. And
doesn't make it easier, man, though, you know.
He kept playing up until, you know, as long as he possibly could. You know? He was on tour in China and... yeah, I miss, you know, there's guys like Idris Muhammad is a drummer that we used to play with. Fantastic. There's a long list.
Sorry.
You know, you've been seeing, you know, every month there's some great musician that passes away.
Oh, I know.
Especially from the old days. Like, what, you know, how do you replace? Like, I guess I won't ever get to play with that guy.
Yeah, for sure, man.
I mean, that's a sort of selfish way of looking at it, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, death is one of those, I think, you know, everybody has their own way of handling that. You know, it's not a, it's, you know, how do you deal with that? It's a pretty individual thing, you know? And I think a lot of times people probably look at things in a way that it allows them to process what's going on with the least emotional damage themselves. That doesn't take away necessarily from the person or whatever, but man, we all have our own set of coping skills and they are what they are, I think.
Yeah. And after a while you just realize this is the way it's just going to be, you know?
Oh, I know.
You have to figure out a way to deal with it. Which when you're young, you don't really even think about it.
No, you're not thinking about it. It's funny because I read an article. Do you have children?
I don't.
I have three kids and I read an article, they're 28, 26, and 18. And I read an article written by a kid probably around my oldest son's age. And the article is talking about, you know, I saw my parents every day, you know, for the first 18, you know, 19, whatever, 20 years of my life, multiple times. And now I'm out of the house and I realize, you know, this kid didn't live near the parents. And he says, you know, I'm only seeing them three times a year and how much time do they have left? And I realize I may see my parents less than 150 times the rest of my life, you know? Yeah. So that was like, holy shit. Yeah. So I sent that to my son. Yeah. And I said, Nick, hey, here you go. Keep this in mind, man. Not
they live in your area?
Yeah, they all live here. I see them all. I mean, I speak to them all three, four times. My daughter lives with me, of course. She's only 18, but I see my both my sons at least once a week. Usually, one of them twice a week, and we speak two or three times a week. So it's, you know, I'm pretty close with them. You know, my wife's really good about, you know, she's keeps everything together. She's always getting them all over for dinner. So it's really good. I have a granddaughter. So, but, you know, yeah. So,
I mean, in terms of that, like how many more times am I going to sit down and play my guitar? You know, there's a finite number of those times.
Yeah. Or like I'll be in driving and I'll listen to a song and I'm like, wow, I haven't heard that song in 3 years. And I'm like, fuck, how many more? This might be the last time I ever hear it again. You know, I don't know. When will it come up on rotation, right? It's yeah. just that's stuff I never, ever in my life thought about. And I avoid thinking about it now because I like really staying positive and having a lot of energy behind what I'm doing. And those thoughts have zero energy. You know, they have negative energy. But it's just shit that goes through your mind once you pass, you know, probably 50 or something like that.
It was interesting, like, hanging out at this studio, you know, Bob Weir's TRI studio. And
how old is he? He's got to be mid to late 70s.
I'm not really sure. He's got to be at least 70, probably a little past 70, I guess. But yeah, he's just still wants to go play music and tour. And, you know, probably that's all he's ever done his whole life, you know. And
yeah, if he's in good health, why wouldn't he?
Great to have like that kind of, you know, exuberance about playing music still. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope I still can do, you know, do that like that.
No, you will. Cause I've spoken to guys. I spoke to a guy named Jim Peterick. Do you know who that is?
No.
Jim Peterick wrote, Eye of the Tiger and from, you know, the Rocky soundtrack. And he also, he's about 75, 6, something like that. And he also wrote, he was with a band called the Ides of March, and they had the big hit like in the late 60s, early 70s called Vehicle. Mm-hmm. I'm your vehicle, baby. I'll take you anywhere. Anyway, that guy was exactly like that. I mean, he's in great shape. He's taking good care of himself, and which I think is a lot of the, although I don't know how Bob Weir is in great shape and taking care of himself, but maybe he's just got amazing genetics, but
he's still doing it. He's taking care of himself enough to.
Yeah. But you know, he was exactly that same way. He was going out, play gigs, and he just lives to write songs. And you know, I was like so impressed. His enthusiasm, that word you just used, for music and to get out there and just freaking do it, was just as high today as, you know, if he was, I don't know, first getting ready to play bands and music, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, I think of sometimes, well, you know, I could just not perform and be a composer. I'd be happy. But then you have to have a deadline or some reason to do what you're doing. I think you have to get something back or have something to aim towards or goal, you know?
Yeah. We're all goal seeking mechanisms.
For me, it doesn't work without a goal. I have to have something to, I mean, you hear about these composers, they found like all these symphonies in their barn, like Charles Ives, you know, and performed, most of his music wasn't performed until after he died, you know. And these guys thought, wow, look at this, all the stuff in this barn he wrote. He just wrote it, you know. Never heard it.
Well, let me repeat something that you said to me. That's why it's important that you just got to go for it and don't be so introverted.
Well, he went for it, but he went for it in his own way, which was writing, you know, himself. He didn't find, do you know about Charles Ives?
I do not, sorry.
Well, he's like, some people think he's America's greatest composer, like a classical composer. He's a big influence on Phil Lesh for, you know, and other people in the rock world too. But he was very extremely experimental for his day. You know, wrote in the early 1900s. So he couldn't get his music performed. I mean, he wanted to get it performed. I'm sure he would have loved to.
Oh, because it was too progressive for the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, imagine living in a situation like that where you can't. That's like hard. It's very hard to imagine that.
Yeah.
Where you're living in a time where, like, you can't play a certain piece of music.
You know, it's not easy now to hire a symphony orchestra to play a music if you have a big piece. You know, that's, imagine how much that would cost.
Well, but if one thing financially, but it's another thing if it's like societally, it's not, you know, you can't get that out there. It's too progressive. That's pretty devastating.
Yeah. He was one of the, he also was in a, he was one of the first people that actually started the insurance industry. He had an insurance company, so that was where he made his money.
Smart dude.
he lived in Connecticut. Anyway,
that's unusual. Hey man, what's your easy question? I'll give you a break. Favorite New York City food?
Well, we live like right next to this restaurant called Fonda that has Oaxacan food.
Has what?
Mexican food from Oaxaca
style. Oh, okay.
And they're about 3 blocks away, so might be my favorite.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
First thing that comes up, you know, in my head.
There's a lot of great Mexican restaurants in the city, man.
Yeah, there didn't used to be. You know, coming from California, that was what I always missed coming out here.
Oh, good Mexican.
You couldn't find it at all.
Yeah.
Now we live in Brooklyn, very near, Mexican neighborhood. So there's tons around here.
That's cool, man. Yeah.
I was, a lot of Californians, you can't believe it when I tell them there's good Mexican food here.
That's very cool. Yeah. We usually Mexican, we go back to the city. Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music, Will?
I like writing, and I like art, like drawing.
Like what kind of drawing? Pencil?
Pencil and acrylic. Pencil, pen.
like a rapidograph, fine needle kind of stuff?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, yeah, I haven't heard that word in a long time. I remember rapidographs from when I was a kid. But
yeah, because now they're just, they're much less complicated. You just got felt tip pens with every freaking diet, you know, every thickness in the world, and you throw it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something I do every. I used to do it all a lot, but now I don't have time, or I don't think I have time. I'm trying to. It's something I'll probably get back to. And
you're the third player in a row that I've interviewed that is involved in drawing.
Hmm.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I never studied art. I had like a printmaking class in high school, but. And that's a slight regret, I guess, that I never took more art classes. But, I'll probably try to do that more. And then writing, I've always written. I've written, just had books that I write, journals or write, that I feel like, you know.
Yeah, all that stuff is very therapeutic and relaxing, writing, drawing.
Yeah. I used to always carry, like in high school, I'd have my drawing book and my writing book that I always carry around with me all the time.
That's great. That's a good outlet. Hey, more people need to do that. You probably have less people, you know, freaking out and doing weird shit.
Of course, now there's so much distraction with YouTube and Netflix and all these things. You know?
Dude, this is the distraction. Freaking cell phone, man.
It's true.
I never forget, I'd go in, my daughter, when she was probably like 14, I'd go in her room and there's three or four friends over and they are all on their phones talking to other people.
And I mean, when I was a kid, we'd like put on a record and draw. And,
yeah, it's just a different, you know. Yeah, it's weird. And I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man because I'm not grumpy about it. It's just different. It's just, I just think that there's a lot less socializing in the world of social media. There's not as a less, you know, actual socializing, you know, it's
and we're sitting here talking to each other on this computer. So.
Right. Right. But we're actually having a conversation though.
Right.
So, I mean, like, you know, this is the thing that I think is missing. If I said something awkward or you said something awkward, the other guy is going to have a reaction. Right. And the other person who said the awkward thing would learn, hey, maybe you shouldn't say that. You don't get that when you're doing that texting shit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no social development. And I think that's really
the emojis or something.
Yeah. But I think that's, I mean, like shit, man, getting along with people is a critical, even in today's day and age where there's so much tech stuff, you got to get along with people, man, because that's important to just like your career and just to make the world easier. You know, and you're not learning that through texting or through.
The first thing is an argument and text.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I don't engage in that ever. No, I've never done that. I won't. I don't want that stress. It's just, I'll make a phone. And I'm the kind of guy, like if I have to give somebody negative news, I pick up the phone and call them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, have to blow something off. I'm not like, hey, sorry. I don't think that's cool. I'd rather, cause I want them to. If they have something to say, I want them to say it to my face. I don't think it's cool not to. One more question. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this was deliberate and how much of this is just a natural part of aging?
Hmm. Well, I think in a way I've gotten less, I've gotten more okay about how my career is going. There was times when I get really stressed out about, oh, I'm not doing well enough, or I gotta book more gigs or do something, you know, and that would be a big stressor. And I think, lately I've been more okay about, well, you know, I didn't get that festival or that gig or that thing, or it's okay, you know.
And you're okay with it.
Okay, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because I'm doing better too.
Yeah, but isn't that funny? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
Right. Are you doing better because you're more okay with you, and then like the vibe attracts more, or you know what I'm saying? Or are you doing better and then you get okay with it?
It's true. I have Dr. John was a guy who I got to play with a few times, and I got to talk to him a lot of times, like maybe 15 times I hung out with him. And one time we were, actually the one time I ever really got to do a festival, we played this 10-year Katrina anniversary, like benefit, you know, and they called me to do it. And we were hanging out. It was like in this little, a minor league baseball field in Biloxi, Mississippi. So we drove there from New Orleans. Mm. And I got to drive, just me and him and a driver, you know, talk to him.
Oh, that's cool.
And then, but we were backstage and I'd been drinking this crappy backstage coffee, and I went over and he was sitting there with that espresso, you know. Like, man, I said, man, where'd you get that? I must have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. he said, man, maybe you're trying too hard. I was like, wow.
He talked just like that. Is that how he talked?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's how he sang. That's so funny.
It's like that. All, yeah, it's,
man, maybe you're just trying too hard. That's awesome.
So I said, well, you know, luckily, a lot of times I'm in the right place at the right time. Like, wow, that's a blessing. But anyway, I just thought, you know, sometimes these elders, you know, they just say a little something that sticks with you.
That's cool. Man, maybe you're just trying too hard.
There's a lot of, I've gotten to play with a lot of elders, and I remember a lot of things they said.
I've interviewed a few guys who play with Dr. John, and they all loved him. They all said very complimentary things. He's very nice, very pleasant. Really enjoyable, total full of energy also, that guy was.
Yeah, he was always, we're saying was, he's still around.
Yeah, he is still around.
He's not really performing anymore though, I guess.
Yeah.
And I had was hoping for a while I could go on tour with him, and I think it would have been great, but it just never happened. But
well, Doc, if you're listening, Will Bernard's waiting for the call.
But you know, some of the things I noticed about him was he was really he really listened to music. You know, he was a real listener, you know, and really aware of lots of different musicians. You know, mostly from the past, but still, you know, he was encyclopedic.
Yeah,
because he started out as a producer. You know, when he was,
oh, I didn't know that,
18 or 19, he was a record producer.
That's wild.
So, kind of A&R scout, you know.
In New Orleans?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool, man.
He was like a bridge between like white and black.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
50s, you know, there wasn't, that was a big deal to mix, you know, mix music, races and music like that. You know?
Do you know who Billy Vera is?
I don't know.
Billy Vera and the Beaters. He's a vocalist, kind of a blue-eyed soul guy. And he was living in – he's from New York, or I think he's from the Midwest, but moved to New York as a very young kid. And I interviewed Billy, and he was the first guy to play at the Apollo with – it was him and a black gal, a female artist who was a vocalist. And it was a big – and this is like in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was a very crazy, well, man. Yeah,
the original, like they would, like there'd be a white guy playing, you know, black music on a white station, and they get like death threats, or you know, or just, like,
it's totally nuts, man.
Yeah, and they'd have to sneak in the back way to the recordings. The white guys would have to sneak in the back way to the black recording studios and stuff. You know,
crazy shit, man. Will, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for everything, man. And you did really good for a shy guy. So feel good about that. Let me tell people where they can find you. Check out Will Bernard's music and support him. It's at willbernard.com. His new project that he's got going on with John Medeski is Mad Skillet, the Mad Skillet Project. It has a Facebook page, so check him out on there and like the page and connect with him. And Will also gives lessons, so if you want to interested in lessons from Will, hit him up.
There's actually on my website, there's a lessons page you can click on.
Awesome.
Get a hold of me.
Awesome. And so if you're a jazz player, you just like the stuff Will's doing, check him out, man. Take some lessons from him. Dude, any final words of wisdom?
Not really. Just hope people check out my my own projects as well. You know, look for in the next year, I'm going to try and release some new music. So,
and are you on social media besides Facebook? Yeah,
all the stuff, Twitter and Instagram, and Facebook.
Awesome. All right, man. Thank you so much for everything. Everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We certainly appreciate your support. Thanks again to Will Bernard for spending time with us. I appreciate it. And make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list where you get advanced notice of guests coming on the show and the opportunity to send in your own questions. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's pair.com.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.